So I want you to imagine your local historically landmarked house. Like, let us say it is this massive, beautiful colonial building built back in the late 1700s.
Oh, I love those old houses. They have so much character.
Right, they really do. But, the local historical society has all these strict rules, and they mandate that the facade absolutely must remain identical to the day it was
Oh,
built.
yeah, you can't even change the paint color without getting like a dozen permits.
Exactly. You can't alter the windows. You definitely cannot remove the columns out front. But imagine if you were to walk inside this particular house today and you find that the original load-bearing walls have just been completely gutted.
Just totally hollowed out on the inside.
Yeah, the plumbing, the wiring, the locks, the entire floor plan, and even the people who actually hold the keys have been completely replaced.
Wow, okay.
So from the street, it looks like the exact same historic house. But if you actually try to live in it today, it functions entirely differently. The outward structure is basically just a historical illusion.
Because the internal operation is completely new. That is a really striking visual.
I mean, it really paints a picture, right? And today we are looking at a deeply complex legal theory that argues this exact phenomenon has happened to the United States Constitution.
And I should really caveat this right out of the gate for everyone listening. We are unpacking a staggering, highly detailed, and frankly, very polarizing legal review article today.
Oh, absolutely. It is a dense one.
Yeah, it was published under a pen name, Publius Custos, and it is part of this broader body of work known as the Operation Firewall series. And, just the title alone gives you a sense of the weight here.
Betrayed by counsel, structural collapse of the constitutional defense function.
Oh.
Yeah, it is not exactly light beach reading.
No, not at all. And Custos is making these massive sweeping claims about the nature of state power and the legitimacy of the entire American justice system. So I want to be super clear, we are not here to validate or debunk this theory today.
Right, we are not taking sides.
Exactly. Our job in this deep dive is to basically play architect. We are going to look at his blueprints and figure out exactly how he believes this invisible internal rewiring of the American Republic was actually accomplished.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because his central thesis is just, well, it is wild. He argues that there was no explicit overthrow of the government, like there was no violent revolution in the streets.
Right, no tanks rolling on the Capitol or anything like that.
Exactly. Instead, the operational core of the Republic was quietly replaced by this administrative and procedural machine, all while wearing the skin of the original Constitution.
The historical facade, just like your house analogy.
Yes, precisely. And to understand how this machine was built, we really have to start by examining the baseline, like the difference between what the American legal system was originally designed to be and what Custos claims it functions as today.
So let us lay that foundation. Because at the founding, the system was built on a framework of strictly limited delegated power.
Which means the government can only do what we specifically give it permission to do, right?
Right. In that original philosophical framework, law precedes government. Like rights exist before the government even enacts them.
Okay, wait, explain that a bit more. How does a law exist before the government?
Well, it is rooted in this concept of natural law. It is the idea that human beings possess inherent rights simply by virtue of existing, breathing, being alive. And those rights aren't granted to you by a king or a president or a legislature.
I see. So if I am alone on a desert island, I still have a right to defend myself,
Yeah.
even if there is no police force to write a law about it.
Exactly. Therefore, the government is really just a temporary fiduciary trust. It is just a tool created by the people, and it is delegated with very specific enumerated powers to protect those pre-existing rights.
I am tracking with that. The Constitution is essentially a charter that just says, hey, here is the very short list of things the government is actually allowed to do.
Yes, and by definition, if it is not on the list, the government just can't do it. Custos leans heavily on that exact premise. Under that original framework, if a government institution acts outside of that specific delegated authority, the act isn't just flawed or, something you can challenge. It is completely void from inception.
Void from inception, meaning it never really existed legally.
All right. There is a famous Supreme Court ruling from the early 1800s that Custos cites, where the Chief Justice famously declared that a legislative act repugnant to the Constitution is void. Like, it literally has no legal force. It is a nullity.
Wow, okay. So the historical baseline was that governmental authority had to be constantly proven. It was never just assumed to be valid just because a judge banged a gavel or some politician passed a bill.
Exactly. But Custis argues that we no longer live in that system. He says we live under what he calls administrative governance.
Administrative governance, I love.
Yeah. Because outwardly, we still have courts, right? We have judges in black robes. We have a legislature passing statutes. Everyone still quotes the Constitution on the news.
The facade of the house looks perfect.
Yes. But operationally, he claims procedural management has entirely replaced constitutional limitation. His argument is that authority is now just presumed simply because an institution exists and it follows its own internal procedures.
So as long as they fill out the right forms, they get to do whatever they want.
Basically, yes. If an agency goes through the proper administrative steps, you know, filing the paperwork, holding the requisite hearings, checking all the procedural boxes, the modern legal system treats their action as completely legitimate.
And they never stop to ask if they were allowed to do it in the first place.
Right. They often never stop to ask that fundamental question of whether the Constitution ever actually delegated the power to do this specific thing.
I mean, I struggle to buy that entirely, though, because aren't procedures just the necessary rules of the game? Like, we are a society of 330 million people now, not just a collection of small agrarian colonies.
True. Things are vastly more complicated today.
Right. You need procedure to manage a modern complex state. I mean, how does a procedural rule book effectively overthrow an entire constitution?
And that is the ultimate friction point of his essay, because Custis isn't arguing that procedure itself is inherently evil or anything like that.
Okay, so he's not anti-rule.
No. He is arguing that when procedure becomes the absolute ultimate measure of legitimacy, it insulates the state from foundational challenges. Procedure essentially replaces substance.
Okay, give me an example of what that substance used to look like.
Well, think about some of the earliest state constitutions. Custis brings up one from Massachusetts from the late 1700s. That document explicitly states that government exists for the common good, for the protection and safety of the people, and this is the crucial part, not for the profit, honor, or private interest of any one man, family, or class of men.
Oh, wow. I mean, they were terrified of the government becoming this self-serving entity, which makes sense. They had literally just fought a brutal war over it.
Exactly. They understood deeply that if the machinery of government began to serve its own institutional continuity, you know, its own survival, its own expansion, and its own procedural ease, rather than the actual constitutional common good, the Republic would be deeply compromised.
And Custis argues that the modern procedural system largely serves to protect its own institutional continuity.
Yes. If the procedure is followed, the system protects itself. It doesn't matter if the outcome actually violates the natural rights of the citizen as long as the paperwork was filed on time.
Man, so if the internal wiring of this historic house has been completely swapped out to protect the administrative machine, I guess the question is, who did the contracting work? Like, who allowed this to happen?
And that brings us to a part of the text that I know genuinely threw you when we were reading it, because it targets the very people we rely on to protect us from state overreach.
Yeah, the defense attorneys. I was not expecting that at all.
Pillar one, the usurpation of defense counsel. It is a wildly provocative argument. Custis asks us to look closely at the Sixth Amendment, which guarantees the right to have the assistance of counsel for their defense.
Right, you have the right to an attorney. We hear it on every cop show ever made.
But we have to strip away our modern assumptions and look at what the word counsel actually meant in the late 18th century versus what it means in a modern courtroom today.
Because when I hear counsel today, I immediately picture a lawyer in a sharp suit who went to a very expensive accredited law school, sat for a grueling multi-day bar exam, and, you know, holds a license issued by the state Supreme Court. That is just the definition of a lawyer to me.
Sure, that is the modern reality. But historically, drawing on the great English legal scholars that the founders read, counsel meant a privy advisor.
A privy advisor. That sounds very formal.
It basically meant an independent advocate. It was someone chosen by the accused personally to assist them in navigating the charges. Their loyalty was entirely 100% to the accused.
Okay, so how is that different from a defense attorney today? Don't they work for the accused?
Well, today, a defense attorney is a state-licensed professional. They are legally mandated to be integrated into state bar associations, which, if you really look at them, are regulatory arms of the state itself. And legally, they are designated as an officer of the court.
An officer of the court. Wow, the structural tension there is obvious when you lay it out like that.
Right, because how can you fight the court if you are an officer of it?
Exactly. The attorney is supposed to be the citizen's fierce, completely independent shield against the coercive power of the state. But their license to practice, their ability to feed their family, and their procedural access to the courtroom are entirely dependent on the approval of that exact same state.
Custis argues this creates a fatal, divided institutional loyalty. The defense attorney is structurally owned by the government's legal apparatus.
So if an attorney fights too aggressively, like outside the accepted procedural norms, what happens?
If they start questioning the fundamental jurisdiction of the court itself, or if they refuse to just play the administrative game, they risk disciplinary action. They could face sanctions or even disbarment from the very judges they are arguing against.
The system literally regulates its own opposition. That is terrifying.
It is a profound conflict of interest baked right into the foundation.
And I have to play devil's advocate here, though, because I think a lot of people listening are probably thinking the same thing. Let's look at a parallel profession, like medicine. We require medical licenses to protect the public from quacks performing surgery in their basements, right?
Of course, licensing implies a standard of care.
And we license engineers so that the bridges we drive over don't just collapse into the river. So doesn't licensing lawyers ensure that if I am facing 20 years in federal prison, the person standing next to me actually knows the rules of evidence?
You want someone competent.
Exactly. I don't want some sovereign citizen quoting the Magna Carta and getting me locked up for life because they don't understand procedure. Doesn't the bar exam fundamentally exist to protect the citizen from incompetence?
Custis definitely anticipates that exact pushback, and his critique requires us to examine what modern legal education and the bar exam actually test.
Okay, what do they test then?
Well, law schools today generally do not test a deep philosophical understanding of natural law. They do not test a student's ability to recognize and resist unconstitutional usurpations of power.
Right, they are not teaching you how to be a revolutionary.
No, they train students to synthesize appellate cases, to navigate incredibly complex regulatory frameworks, and to comply with institutional procedure.
So they train them to be administrative technicians, basically, not constitutional philosophers.
Custis would absolutely agree with that characterization. The educational model produces technicians who are trained to lubricate the procedural system and look at the Supreme Court's own jurisprudence, which Custis weaves into the argument.
What have the courts said about this?
In several landmark cases over the last century, the Supreme Court has explicitly acknowledged that effective counsel must be untrammeled and unimpaired by conflicting interests.
Meaning you can't serve two masters.
Right. The court recognizes that divided loyalties destroy the defense. In a foundational 1984 ruling regarding the standard for ineffective assistance of counsel, the court defined effective assistance entirely in terms of preserving the integrity of the adversarial process.
Meaning the system only produces actual justice if the two sides are genuinely fighting each other tooth and nail.
Yes. The adversarial process is supposed to be the engine of truth in the American system. But Custis argues that when the overwhelming majority of criminal cases, and we are talking upwards of 95% here, are resolved through plea bargaining, the adversarial process is completely dead.
Wow, 95%. That is almost every single case.
It is, because plea bargaining is just procedural negotiation. In that environment, the defense attorney functions less as a constitutional shield and more as an intermediary.
A broker.
Exactly. A broker who just helps the defendant navigate the state's administrative machinery to secure a predictable outcome.
Man, let me test an analogy here to see if I am really grasping the depth of this. It is like you are an employee and you are being sued by a massive, completely ruthless corporation.
Okay, I am with you.
And the court rules state that the only person allowed to represent you in this high-stakes arbitration is an employee of that exact same corporation's human resources department.
Oh, that is a fantastic comparison.
Right, because the HR rep knows the company rulebook perfectly. They're highly trained, they passed all the internal exams, they might even genuinely want to get you a decent severance package. But at the end of the day, their paycheck comes from the corporation.
Their office is in the corporate building.
Exactly. And if they make the CEO too angry, they get fired.
Mm.
So who are they ultimately trying to keep happy? You or the company?
The analogy highlights the structural conflict perfectly. And I should add, Custis is very careful to note that he isn't saying individual public defenders or private defense attorneys are corrupt or acting in bad faith.
Oh, sure. I know some defense attorneys who work incredibly hard.
Right. Many are incredibly dedicated advocates who fight desperately for their clients. His point is that the structure itself places them in an impossible, deeply compromised position. They are expected to wage constitutional warfare against a system that they are institutionally dependent upon for their professional survival.
Which is just an unwinnable game.
Yeah.
So if the defense has been structurally handcuffed by this state licensing and procedural capture who is sitting across the aisle taking advantage of that weakness, like, how did the role of the prosecutor mutate to fill that void?
And this brings us right to pillar two, the administrative transformation of the prosecutor. Today, we just accept the permanent salary district attorney or the federal prosecutor as an inevitable, unquestionable part of the government landscape.
Yeah, it's just a normal job. You go to law school, you become a prosecutor.
But Custis points out that at the founding, criminal prosecution was largely not an autonomous, permanent institutional enterprise.
It's localized, right? Like citizen-driven. I remember reading something about that.
Heavily localized. If someone committed a tangible harm, you know, murder, theft, assault the community, often through a grand jury of normal citizens, initiated the accusation.
So it wasn't just one guy in an office deciding who gets charged.
No, the power to accuse and investigate was not monopolized by a standing army of government lawyers. But today, Custis argues modern prosecutors basically act as administrative managers of regulatory compliance.
Okay, unpack that phrase for me. Managers of regulatory compliance. Because when I hear the word prosecutor, I think of someone trying to put away a bank robber or a serial killer, not someone managing regulations.
To understand that, you have to think about the sheer massive volume of modern statutory law. The federal criminal code alone contains thousands upon thousands of offenses.
And that is just the stuff Congress passed directly.
Right, that doesn't even count the estimated hundreds of thousands of federal regulations that carry criminal penalties. And many of these offenses are what the law calls malum prohibitum.
Malum prohibitum. Meaning what, exactly?
It means they are wrong simply because the state prohibited them. It's contrasted with malum in se, which means things that are wrong in themselves, naturally, like murder or stealing.
So malum prohibitum is like you filled out a tax form with the wrong color ink, or you transported a certain type of fish across state lines.
Exactly. And because the code is so unimaginably expansive, almost anyone engaged in complex business or, you know, daily modern life could technically be in violation of something.
Which gives the prosecutor just an unbelievable amount of leverage over the average person.
Absolute leverage. The prosecutor has virtually unchecked discretionary power over who to investigate, who to charge, what specific combination of statutes to charge them with, and what terms to offer in a plea bargain.
So they aren't just seeking justice for a specific victim. They are managing the flow of the whole administrative system by deciding which levers to pull.
Precisely. And Custis digs up some fascinating provisions from historical state constitutions that really highlight how far we've drifted from the original intent regarding accusation.
Oh, yeah. He mentioned a few specific states.
He points to the foundational constitutions of places like Alabama, Michigan, Georgia, and Wyoming, among others. These foundational state documents explicitly preserve the right of the people to prosecute or defend causes directly.
Wait, so the people themselves had the power to prosecute?
Yes. Wyoming's constitution has this section that is incredibly blunt. It states that absolute, arbitrary power over the lives, liberty, and property of free men exists nowhere in a republic, not even in the largest majority.
That is a powerful sentence.
The founders of these systems never intended to give the state a total exclusive monopoly on who gets to bring an accusation.
Why were they so terrified of a state monopoly on accusation, though? Was it just fear of the British crown repeating itself?
Partly, yes. Because when you combine permanent investigative coordination, like a modern FBI or a massive state police force, with unchecked charging discretion, and you hand them the immense procedural leverage of the modern courtroom, you combine it all into one institutional office.
You create a juggernaut.
You create an entity that operates almost entirely outside of local citizen accountability. The prosecutor literally holds all the cards.
And this ties right back to the plea bargaining we discussed earlier, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because the modern system would literally collapse under its own weight by Tuesday afternoon if every single defendant actually demanded a jury trial.
Oh, completely. The courts simply do not have the time, the judges, or the money to try every case on the docket.
So the prosecutor uses the threat of catastrophic stacked charges, what they call the trial penalty, right?
Yeah.
to force a plea deal.
Yes. The trial penalty is the massive difference between the sentence offered in a plea and the sentence you will get if you lose at trial.
So the prosecutor is effectively acting as the accuser, the judge, and the jury, all in a back room. They just negotiate the price of a penalty with the compromised defense attorney rather than actually having to prove a crime beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury of citizens in an open courtroom.
The form of justice remains, you know.
All right.
There is an official indictment document. There is a physical courtroom with a flag. A judge signs the final order.
The facade of the historic house.
Exactly. But the actual constitutional function of a trial has been completely replaced by negotiated procedural management.
It's just staggering when you zoom out like that.
Yeah.
But Custis doesn't stop there. Because if this unchecked administrative power wasn't bad enough when it's taking away liberty through plea deals, he points out that it is also literally taking people's property to fund itself.
Pillar 3, the self-funding machine.
Civil asset forfeiture. We all know what this is. It's in the news constantly. It's when the state seizes your cash or your car without actually convicting you of a crime. But what Custis points out is the terrifying constitutional math behind it.
He focuses intensely on this self-funding mechanism. He describes it as the administrative seizure of property and the total displacement of due process. And from a constitutional perspective, this is a massive inversion of the foundational social contract.
How so?
He relies on some very old foundational historical legal maxims to explain why, specifically the Latin maxim nemo dat quod non habet, which translates to no one can give what he does not possess.
Okay, walk me through the mechanics of that maxim in this specific context. How does that relate to a cop taking my cash on the highway?
Well, the core premise of the American Republic is that the people possess inherent rights, and they delegate a small portion of that power to the government to protect those rights.
Right.
We talked about that.
Like the limited delegation of power.
But the people never possess the right to just arbitrarily steal their neighbor's car without proving the neighbor harmed them.
I mean, obviously not. If I do that, it is Grand Theft Auto.
Exactly. Therefore, the people could never have delegated that power to the government in the first place. The government cannot exercise a power it was never given.
So under the traditional model, the state had the absolute burden of proving wrongdoing before they could take anything.
Yes. They had to prove a crime actually occurred before it could deprive a citizen of life, liberty, or property.
But in modern civil forfeiture, they use this bizarre legal fiction. They charge the property itself with a crime. You see these wild case names on the docket, like United States versus $40,000 in U.S. currency.
It sounds absurd when you say it out loud, but that is exactly how it works. And because the property itself is treated as the offending party, all the constitutional protections afforded to a human citizen are entirely bypassed.
Because a stack of cash doesn't have Fifth Amendment rights.
Right. So the burden of proof radically shifts. The citizen often has to affirmatively prove their own innocence and prove the innocent origin of the property just to get it back.
Which requires hiring a lawyer, which we already established as part of the system, and navigating complex administrative hearings and spending years fighting. And often that costs more in legal fees than the seized property is actually worth.
So most people just give up. They walk away.
But it is the incentive structure that Custis highlights that really turns this from a quirky legal loophole into a full-blown structural collapse.
The institutional incentive structure is the absolute core issue here. Under specific federal statutes regarding asset forfeiture, the Attorney General is allowed to share seized assets with the local and state law enforcement agencies that actually participated in the seizure.
Oh, they call that equitable sharing, don't they?
Yes, equitable sharing. And various state laws, like the ones in California, for instance, have similar provisions where a substantial portion of the proceeds goes directly into funds that support law enforcement budgets.
So they use it to purchase equipment, fund operations, pay for training.
Exactly. It goes right back to the department that made the seizure.
Let us look at the blueprint of the house again, because this feels like a massive code violation. Think about Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution, the Appropriations Clause.
A very important clause.
Right, because the whole point of that clause was that the legislature, the body most directly accountable to the voters, controls the purse strings. That is supposed to be the ultimate check on executive power. If the police or the military want more money to buy toys, they have to go to the people's representatives and publicly justify it.
Custis asks the critical question here. What happens to that constitutional balance when an enforcement agency can self-fund through confiscation?
They don't need the legislature anymore.
Exactly. By taking property directly from citizens and keeping the proceeds, these administrative agencies bypass the legislature entirely. They become financially independent of public accountability.
That is incredibly dangerous.
It is. When enforcement institutions directly benefit from confiscatory practices, the deprivation of property transforms. It goes from being a constitutionally restrained public function into a self-sustaining administrative revenue mechanism.
A for-profit policing model. I am just baffled by how this persists in the courts. I mean, if an unconstitutional act is void from the start, like the Chief Justice said back in the 1800s, why isn't the judiciary stepping in and shutting this down?
That is the logical question.
Right. Custis cites a major Supreme Court case from 1886, which explicitly stated that an unconstitutional act is not a law. It confers no rights. It imposes no duties. It is, in legal contemplation, as inoperative as though it had never been passed. So if that is the baseline, how on earth are police departments legally buying armored vehicles with seized cash?
Because, as Custis argues, the system uses procedure to validate itself, which completely insulates the underlying constitutional question.
Explain that. How does procedure hide the constitutional problem?
Well, if the agency filled out the right seizure forms, if they provided the statutorily required notice to the property owner, and if they followed all the strict administrative timelines, the modern judicial system just assumes the seizure is lawful.
Ah, I see.
The deeper question of whether the Constitution actually allows an executive agency to bypass the legislature and self-fund by seizing property without a criminal conviction, that question just gets buried. It gets buried under layers and layers of procedural compliance.
Wow. And that leads us directly to the role of the judges themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the defense is compromised and the prosecutor is unchecked and the police are self-funding, the judge is supposed to be the referee, right? They are the ones who are supposed to throw the flag and stop the madness.
But Custis argues the judge's role has been completely transformed as well. This is pillar four.
The transformation of the judge and the vanishing jury.
To really understand this transformation, we have to dedicate some time to a vital historical distinction that has been largely erased from modern consciousness. And that is the difference between law, with a capital L, and equity.
I have heard those terms thrown around, but how did they actually function differently back in the day?
So at the founding, and inherited from a long English tradition, courts of law and courts of equity, which were often called chancery courts, were entirely distinct systems. They were completely separate.
Okay, separate buildings, separate judges.
Often, yes. Law dealt with strict, fixed rules. It had rigidly defined jurisdictional boundaries, and most importantly, it absolutely required juries.
So if I sue my neighbor because he broke a contract or his cow trampled my fence, that is law.
Yes, you went to a court of law. The rules were highly predictable, but sometimes they were almost too rigid to offer true justice in weird, nuanced situations.
Okay, so where does equity come in?
Equity was a separate, exceptional system. It was designed for situations where strict common law wasn't adequate to provide a remedy. It involved vast judicial discretion.
Give me an example of what an equity judge could do.
Well, they had the power to issue injunctions, like forcing someone to do something or stop doing something rather than just making them pay money. And it operated entirely by the judge's own conscience, usually without a jury.
So law was the strict rule book,
yeah.
And equity was the judge's personal sense of fairness.
Precisely. But the founders were deeply, deeply suspicious of equity power.
Because it is basically one guy making up the rules based on his feelings.
Exactly. It relied on the arbitrary discretion of one person rather than fixed law and a jury of citizens. But in 1938, the federal procedural rules fundamentally changed. They merged law and equity into a single proceeding before a single judge.
Wow. And Custis argues that this procedural merger fundamentally broke the constitutional balance.
Yes. Because it infected the strict, predictable rules of law with the limitless, arbitrary discretion of equity. It turned judges from neutral arbiters who were bound by strict procedural boundaries into these managerial overseers with vast discretionary power.
So a modern judge can use both the strict rulebook and the arbitrary fairness wand whenever they want.
Exactly. They can issue sweeping injunctions. They manage complex institutional reform litigation, and they can literally force settlements, exercising the kind of unilateral power that was historically reserved only for very limited, exceptional equity cases.
Think of a baseball umpire. Historically, the umpire's job in a court of law is just to call balls and strikes based on a strictly defined rule book, right?
Right. The strike zone is fixed. It doesn't change.
But merging law and equity is like giving that exact same umpire the power to unilaterally change the size of the strike zone in the middle of the third inning, just based on what they personally think is quote-unquote fair for the game in that exact moment.
That is a great way to visualize the discretion they gained.
And on top of that, with the decline of the jury, it is like the umpire now has the power to lock the gates and kick all the fans out of the stadium entirely.
The fans being the jury in this analogy.
Right, because the jury is the public watching the game, keeping everyone honest, holding the system accountable. Custos points to the tragic decline of the jury as an absolute cornerstone of this structural collapse.
It is a massive loss. William Blackstone, the great legal commentator, called the jury the glory of the English law.
The glory of the law. That is high praise.
He said that because it was the ultimate constitutional barrier between the citizen and the coercive power of the state. It was the moment where everyday people had to look at the law, look at the facts, and physically agree to authorize state violence or punishment against one of their neighbors.
But today, through the explosion of plea deals in criminal court that we talked about, and, you know, mandatory arbitration clauses, settlements, and summary judgments managed by judges in civil court, the jury has been almost entirely neutralized.
Custis argues the people have literally been evicted from the justice system. The administrative system prefers the predictable, smooth management of a single judge over the unpredictable, messy, democratic voice of a jury.
But what happens when a citizen tries to fight back? Say, I am in court, I have no jury, my state-appointed lawyer is just playing the procedural game, and I decide to stand up and say to the judge, hey, show me your constitutional jurisdiction to do this. I do not consent to this administrative process.
What happens then?
Yeah. What is the mechanism the judge actually uses to maintain control in that moment?
Custis points to the radical expansion of summary contempt power.
Contempt of court. You see it on TV all the time.
Right. But historically, contempt of court was a very, very narrow power. It was used strictly to maintain physical order and decorum in a courtroom.
So if you were shouting over a witness,
right,
or physically threatening the bailiff?
Exactly. If you were throwing chairs, the judge could hold you in contempt to restore order so the trial could actually continue.
Which makes total sense. You can't have a fair trial if people are rioting in the gallery.
But Custis argues that today, contempt is frequently used to enforce substantive procedural compliance and to completely silence jurisdictional challenges.
But I just asked the judge to prove their authority.
If a citizen stands up and peacefully but firmly questions the court's underlying constitutional authority, the judge can use summary contempt to throw them in jail instantly without a trial.
Just for asking the question.
Yes. The judge essentially becomes the accuser, the victim of the supposed contempt, the adjudicator, and the punisher, all in one single moment.
It is the ultimate trump card. If you challenge the system's authority to act, the system just uses its procedural power to lock you in a cage until you agree to play by its rules.
Custis notes that those historical state constitutions, like the ones in Georgia and Wyoming we mentioned earlier, were designed specifically to protect against this exact kind of arbitrary, unilateral deprivation of liberty without a lawful conviction by a jury.
But the modern procedural merger bypasses those protections entirely. Man, let's step back and look at this whole terrifying blueprint we have sketched out so far.
It is a lot to take in.
It really is. We have defense attorneys who were structurally tied to the state's bar associations, acting as basically procedural brokers. We have prosecutors acting as permanent administrative managers, leveraging massive statutory codes to force pleas.
Right.
We have a self-funding enforcement machine that just bypasses the legislature entirely through civil forfeiture. And we have judges acting as discretionary managers who wield contempt power and have entirely sidelined the citizen jury.
And when you put all four of those massive elements together, Custis introduces the final and, frankly, I think the most chilling conceptual mechanism in the entire text.
What is it?
He calls it institutional circularity.
Institutional circularity. It sounds like a snake eating its own tail.
That is exactly what it is. It is the idea that the system validates itself entirely through internal repetition rather than external constitutional proof. The institutions basically reinforce each other in a closed loop.
Walk me through how that loop actually operates in practice.
Okay, so the legislature passes a vaguely worded statute. Then, an unelected administrative agency creates massive volumes of binding regulations based on that vague statute. Then, the permanent prosecutor charges a citizen based on those agency regulations.
Okay, I'm following.
Then the state-licensed defense attorney negotiates a procedural plea bargain to avoid a catastrophic trial penalty. And finally, the judge manages and signs off on the settlement.
So every single piece of the system assumes the other piece acted constitutionally, but no one ever actually stops to prove it.
Exactly. Jurisdiction is just presumed. It is never proven.
It is a perfectly sealed ecosystem. I'm going to use a modern analogy here just to make sure I'm fully wrapping my head around this.
Yeah.
Let us say you go to a casino and you realize their slot machines are mathematically rigged in a way that flat out violates state gaming laws.
Okay, a rigged casino.
Yeah. You want to challenge the casino, yeah, but the laws have been rewritten so that you have to use the casino's specific complaint forms. You have to file a complaint with the casino's own floor manager. And the hearing takes place in the casino's back office, presided over by a casino executive. And the only person allowed to help you articulate your argument is an employee of the casino who will definitely be fired if they argue that the machines are fundamentally illegal.
The HR rep again.
Right. And oh, by the way, if you get frustrated and point out that the entire process is a total sham, the executive can just throw you in the casino's basement jail for contempt. The house always wins because the house makes all the procedural rules and manages every single participant.
It is an inescapable loop. That is brilliant. And Custis is very specific about the actual legal jargon, the specific judicial doctrines that are used to maintain this closed loop and build a moat around the administrative state.
He targets specific doctrines.
Yes. We need to unpack three specific concepts he targets: standing, exhaustion of administrative remedies, and immunity.
Let us break those down because they sound like really dry legal technicalities, but Custis is saying they are the actual weapons of structural collapse. Let's start with standing.
So standing determines whether you even have the right to step into a courtroom to complain in the first place. Rooted in Article 3 of the Constitution, modern courts have developed a very strict test, often citing major Supreme Court decisions from the last few decades.
What is the test?
You must prove an injury in fact that is concrete and particularized. It must be directly traceable to the defendant's action, and it must be redressable by the court.
I mean, that sounds reasonable on paper. You shouldn't be able to sue over something that doesn't actually affect you personally.
But Custis argues the doctrine is weaponized to protect the state. Imagine if the government engages in a massive systemic constitutional violation, say a blanket surveillance program that spies on everyone or a really broad regulatory overreach.
Okay.
The government lawyers will argue that because everyone is affected, no individual citizen can show a specific localized injury unique to them. Therefore, no one has standing to challenge the program. Yes. The court dismisses the case on procedural grounds before ever even looking at whether the surveillance itself violates the Fourth Amendment. The unconstitutional act survives simply because procedure blocked the challenge at the door.
Wow. They literally use the scale of the violation to protect the violation.
Oh, okay. What about exhaustion of administrative remedies? That sounds exhausting just saying it.
This is perhaps the most draining mechanism for the average citizen. Let us say you own a small farm, and the Environmental Protection Agency suddenly decides a puddle on your land is a quote-unquote navigable waterway under federal regulation.
A puddle, okay.
And they decide to fine you $10,000 a day. Now, you believe the EPA's regulation completely violates the statute and the Constitution.
So I sue them in federal court to stop the fines.
You try. But the government lawyers will immediately file a motion to dismiss your lawsuit, citing the doctrine of exhaustion of administrative remedies. They will argue that before you can even bother a real federal judge, you must first go through the EPA's entire internal appeals process.
What does that entail? You have to file an appeal with the EPA's regional director. Then you have to have a hearing before an administrative law judge who, by the way, is employed by the EPA.
Oh, come on.
Then you have to appeal to the EPA's appellate board in Washington.
Which takes years, I am assuming, and hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees.
Yes, and you are fighting inside the casino using the casino's rules. Custis points out that this doctrine essentially forces citizens to submit to the jurisdiction of the very administrative agency they are claiming has no constitutional jurisdiction in the first place. You are bled completely dry by procedure before you ever reach a real constitutional forum.
That's just brutal. And finally, the third doctrine, immunity. We hear about qualified immunity for police officers all the time, but it goes way deeper than that, doesn't it?
Much deeper. Prosecutors enjoy absolute immunity for their charging decisions, even if they act maliciously or hide evidence. Judges have absolute judicial immunity. agencies have sovereign immunity.
So nobody's personally accountable.
Custos argues that these judicially created doctrines, they weren't in the Constitution, judges just made them up, ensure that the individuals operating the administrative machine face zero personal, financial, or legal risk for violating the Constitution. And when there is no risk to the operator, the machine expands aggressively.
It's the ultimate realization of what the French philosopher Montesquieu warned about, isn't it?
Yes. Custos heavily references Montesquieu's warnings on the consolidation of power. The founding fathers designed the separation of powers executive, legislative, judicial, so that ambition would counteract ambition, as Madison wrote.
Right.
The branches were supposed to be fiercely protective of their own turf, constantly fighting each other for power, which practically protected the citizen who was caught in the crossfire.
But Custos is arguing that today, the branches just aren't fighting each other at all.
They aren't. Because we no longer have distinct branches with distinct interests. We have an interconnected professional network of lawyers, judges, agency directors, and politicians who span across all the branches.
A unified administrative class.
Exactly. They all went to the same elite law schools. They are all part of the same bar associations. And they all rely on the exact same administrative continuity to maintain their positions and their power. They do not want to dismantle the machine. They all just want their turn to drive it. The ambition doesn't counteract ambition anymore. It colludes.
Man. So we have looked at a truly staggering theory today. This deep dive has taken us through the idea that the American legal system has undergone a quiet, invisible structural collapse of its foundational constitutional defenses.
A total rewiring of the historic house.
Exactly. It happened through the mandatory licensing and procedural capture of defense attorneys. It happened through the mutation of localized grand juries into permanent, unchecked administrative prosecutors. It happened through the self-funding, constitution-bypassing mechanism of civil asset forfeiture. And it happened through the merger of law and equity, transforming judges into discretionary managers who completely sideline the jury and weaponize contempt to protect the closed loop.
My final takeaway for anyone absorbing this is to really remember the scale of Custos's critique here. This is not an argument about a few corrupt politicians or a bad judge in a specific town.
No, it is way bigger than that.
It is a profound, structural, philosophical critique of the system itself. It forces us to step out of the daily political noise and ask a truly terrifying question. Are we a society governed by the fixed, foundational, delegated laws of a constitution? Or have we slowly transitioned into a society managed by the fluid, self-serving, unaccountable procedures of an administrative state?
And that leaves us with a final thought to mull over, returning one last time to our historic house analogy. Custos has shown us how he believes the system created this closed, self-ratifying loop to protect itself from constitutional challenges.
They change the locks from the inside.
Yes, and they control the courts, they control the lawyers, and they control the entire administrative appeals process. But historically, when a system becomes entirely self-validating and completely insulates itself from the people, when juries are sidelined, when standing is denied, when public accountability is replaced by absolute administrative immunity, how does a society practically withdraw its consent? If the only legal avenues for challenging the system are tightly controlled by that very same system, where does the everyday citizen go to find true justice? Thank you for joining us on this intense intellectual journey today. Keep looking closely at the blueprints and never stop questioning the structures around you.